Thanks for the introduction, and thanks for having me here today. I'll start with a little bit of an overview, although Ted kind of went through some of it. So Central East Correctional Center is a huge facility. It's about 10 acres under roof, 522,000 square feet of physical space. Our total capacity is 1,245. Our operational capacity is not quite as high, so with the changes to the conditions of confinement we can keep people in, we've had to adapt some of those double bunk spaces into single occupancy, so our operational capacity is probably more around 1,100. I'm not sure exactly what our count was this morning, but it's probably it's been hovering around 1,120 inmates on any given day right now. Our base budget is just over $73 million. We employ somewhere around 700 staff. It does fluctuate in and out. We do have people that come in and new people and people that leave for various reasons. So admission criteria, we house sentenced offenders that are sentenced to 2 years, less a day or less. But that only makes up about 20% of our population. About 80% of our population are guys that are waiting trial. Our catchment area goes as far as Newmarket Court, Oshawa or Durham Court, Colberg, and then as far north as Minden, and then of course Lindsay and Peterborough. Our non-management staff are union represented by OPSU. Note, they've moved to binding arbitration, so their contract has expired and it's going through that process, so it's a lot better for us from a facility perspective to do binding arbitration than the strikes and whatnot of the past, so that's definitely a positive change. We have institutional work programs, so as stated, we make license plates. We also make clothing, although we've gotten away from the standard clothing. I guess it's cheaper to produce it elsewhere than it is, even despite our free labor force. So what we do produce is the security clothing, the mattresses, and the suicide gowns and stuff like that. So I'll get into specialized care units as promised a little bit later. Going through my notes here, more for me than for you guys. But so we have a variety of staff. Obviously, we have correctional officers. We have nurses. We have a psychology department. We have social workers. We have kitchen staff, maintenance staff, so we have a variety of different employment opportunities at the jail. One of our big changes recently has been video court, so with COVID, obviously, we weren't transporting offenders back and forth to court, so we just finished installing 13 new video suites. We went from, on any given day, well, when the facility first started open, we probably moved about 130 courts a day back and forth to those jurisdictions. Was probably down pre-COVID to about 75 or 80 a day as our video courts were increasing. So at that time, probably did about 40 video courts a day. Now we do about 130 video courts and send about 40 guys in person to court every day. We run a backpack program. That's for the guys that are getting released that have no fixed address. So donations from the community put those things together. We're able to send people out with a list of community resources that are available to them, as well as some hygiene items and some clean clothes for them to start off with. We've recently increased our NILO complement, so our Native Institutional Liaison Officer. They do Indigenous programming as well as do Indigenous culture awareness for our staff. Currently, several projects on the go, so we did just finish up our video court suites. We're also installing, basically tripling our number of cameras in the institutions. We're doing a full electronic security upgrade, so it'll be 100% camera coverage for all inmate-occupied areas once that project is complete. One of the big changes that's coming down for us was actually supposed to be implemented on September 18th, but we're not going to make that deadline for this as a rank restructure. So just some background that's not in the slides, but really stemmed from a grievance way back probably in around 2011 that finally was settled, where OPSU won the right to represent sergeants. There's obviously some interesting twists to that because there's management responsibilities along with that position. So as a result, the ministry has kind of gone through to try and split that position into staff sergeants and corporals to divide those responsibilities. So the actual hiring and firing portion of the management responsibilities will stay outside of the union, and the supervisory portion of it on the floor, making sure that we're doing meeting our commitments as far as patrols or compliance paperwork and that kind of thing, that we're meeting those, that those supervisory roles will stay within the union. So they were last sticky before they got rained on. So as far as the people that, how they did this is everyone that was in a sergeant position got the opportunity to elect to go through to either be a staff sergeant or to be a corporal. Fortunately for us, we didn't have to run competitions for our staff sergeant positions because we had enough positions for people, all the people that wanted to move up versus staying. It's kind of a lateral move to stay as a corporal. We had enough positions, so that was a good thing that we didn't end up having to compete for those positions and we didn't have to displace people when we were able to place them in the rank that they wanted to land in. So some of the benefits of going to the corporal or to the staff sergeant position, it's going to increase the oversight on our units. So instead of having just one sergeant that's looking after an area, now you're going to have a corporal that's on the floor that's going to watch the day-to-day stuff. You're also going to have a staff sergeant that's going to be in that area to oversee that whole area, as well as review all the reports that come out, something that that one person was doing in the past. So that's going to be a positive for us. Positive for them will be the higher pay band. So I don't know exactly what it is, but a staff sergeant tops out around $110,000 a year. A corporal is going to top out somewhere around high 90s. So currently, that's where the sergeant band is now. So, it's not a pay decrease to go to that position, but it's not a pay increase either. So, another benefit's consistency. So, being able to split the two positions, we're able to assign a staff sergeant to each of the areas. Means that it's going to be a smaller complement to that area. We're going to have a little bit more consistency and kind of a team of three that's going to oversee two areas, which is going to be a benefit to us because there'll be some consistency in how it is now. Traditionally, we've struggled to get people to move to management positions. For whatever reason, a lot of staff are apprehensive to leave the support of the union to move into a management role. There's also some pay administration issues that come along with that, we'll say. There's benefit definitely in moving to a management role if you've reached the top rate of your union role, but if you move earlier, you tend to move quicker through your pay band as a union member than you do in management positions. So that's a consideration that definitely deters some people from taking that jump. Schedule. Because of the lower number of staff sergeants over sergeants, the majority of those staff sergeant and higher-ranking positions benefit from having, although still on 12-hour straight-day schedules, so that's definitely an advantage to someone taking a staff sergeant position if they sleep as well as I do on nights. Drawbacks, talked about the pay structure, so the difficulty in moving through your pay band as a manager as opposed to a union member is obviously a drawback. And for some, the increased management responsibilities. So sergeants traditionally, although they had the delegated authority to take on those HR-related roles, traditionally didn't and got spent most of their time in direct supervision of the units and really dealing with the offenders and their issues. So this will be a little bit of an increase in responsibility. Obviously, with those responsibilities, you guys, from what I understand, we're probably all businessmen and understand that when you're dealing with people, you have to make difficult decisions and have difficult conversations. So that's probably a big jump for a lot of people that haven't had to have that role in their sergeant role currently. Probably blocking that for a lot of people. So conversely, for those that chose to go to a corporal position, the benefits of the institution is going to be increased supervision of daily routines. So currently sergeants end up bouncing between a couple of units. What we're looking at with this change will be somebody that's stationed right on the unit, that's assigned there every day, that will be there throughout the entire unlock period to make sure that people are directly doing what they're doing. So there's going to be some increased supervision. Hopefully that will lead to better compliance and better safety for the staff and the inmates. Defined pay progression. So as I stated before, when the move from sergeant to corporal, the pay bands didn't change, but what did change is instead of being a pay-for-performance model where you can only move so many percent a year based on your performance, it's a guaranteed pay progression through a grid, and I think it works out to be somewhere around the neighborhood of 4.7% per year in progression through that grid. So that's definitely a benefit for somebody that's lower in the pay band currently, for them to have that opportunity to move up a little bit quicker. Again, consistency, it's the same thing. When we have the appropriate number of staff, because these positions are a little bit more desirable because they are still in the union and there is pay, we're able to actually recruit for them. So there's some benefit in having those positions filled and getting that consistency for the staff as well as the inmates and where they know what to expect in their daily routine. Drawbacks, obviously when you're part of a union, you pay union dues, so that's one of the considerations. And, of course, the lower pay band, although that might be a benefit to be able to move through it, eventually there is some financial incentive to move into the higher level position of staff sergeant. So some of the institutional challenges. Because this project's been going on for a couple of years, there's a lot of uncertainty, so it's made it really difficult for us to recruit managers in this period of influx before this is implemented. That obviously results in lockdowns on the units, which as much as it sounds like it's safer to have them secured in their cells, it increases the tension, increases the frustration among the inmates, so it actually makes the building less safe when we're locked down than when the inmates are getting what they're entitled to. Because of those shortages, people are moved around. We basically prioritize the places that need to get out today. We move people around on a daily basis, so we don't get the benefit of that consistency of somebody managing the same group or carrying through an inmate's issue from start to finish because they're bouncing from area to area. And obviously, with all that moving around and bouncing between, we suffer from limited supervision on the units. That definitely, I'm sure that all of you guys or most of you have had employees. If you're not supervising them, they're probably not doing exactly what you're expecting them to do at every moment of the day. So it definitely is a challenge for us, and it definitely affects our compliance with our own policies. So okay, so anticipated benefits. So the division of supervisory and management roles, I think this is a big benefit in this project just because it's hard for somebody to focus on the HR perspective and be on the floor and supervising inmates and doing incident packages and all of those things that go along with that. It's certainly in a union environment, managing, you have to dot all your T's or dot all your I's across all your T's. There's a lot of consultation with HR, ER when you're going through those processes. So pulling people's focus away from dealing with that issue that they're dealing with, whether it be accommodations, whether it be discipline, whether, you mean, any of those sort of things, taking their focus away and breaking that up, we're obviously not working as efficiently as we could. As well, you mean, we're not getting things out time in a timely manner because people are bouncing between duties. So I think in both the frontline management or supervision and the back-end management, it's going to be a lot more efficient for us to work through those. Increase in available resources. As I said, it's easier to recruit for union positions, so we're anticipating that we're going to not have as much of a struggle to fill those positions, so that will obviously lead to an increase in available resources to fill those shifts, less lockdowns, and safety. And then the big one, which I've touched on a couple times already, is consistency on the units. I don't know if you guys want me to go through and talk about segregation first, or if you guys have any questions on what I've presented so far. I guess I'll leave it up to you guys. Do you guys have any questions on what I've talked about so far? As a correctional officer? So the correctional officer's basic requirements is grade 12. Obviously, we're probably drawing from a pool of applicants that most of them are coming in with either significant job experience or they're, you mean, educated at least a college or university level. We do get a pretty good crew of people to start off in that role. I mean, it's a decent paying job, especially in the smaller centers versus, I mean, I think the bigger centers when you get into Toronto or whatever, there's a little bit more competition for kind of the pay area we're at. But I guess so on paper, it's grade 12. In reality, you're probably looking at college, university, or some life skills to kind of back that up. Yes? It's definitely stressful. I don't know that I have any statistics to say how it compares to other, emergency services people, but certainly it is. We do have difficult people to deal with, and I would say that it is a high stress job, especially from the management perspective. Dealing with unionized employees, they can sometimes be a little bit more entitled, personal opinion, I guess, but there's also a lot more steps to, although you're never looking to get rid of somebody, you're looking to change their behavior, but when you get to that point, it's a lot harder to discipline somebody or to terminate somebody in a unionized environment. So you do end up dealing with the same people over and over and over again. Unfortunately, I do honestly believe that 90% of our staff are awesome. They come in, they do their job, they do a great job, and they go home, but that's not the people that we generally end up dealing with from a management perspective. So as far as burnout, I think, especially recently, the focus on mental health, the focus on post-traumatic stress disorder, we've seen a lot of impact for that. We probably have anywhere in the neighborhood of 80 to 100 staff off on a PTSD or stress-related leave at any given time. Obviously, that puts the stress on our resources, puts the stress on our management. Like every WSIB injury, there's people that are legitimately off on it, there's people that aren't. But what we've seen recently, especially when you talk about the opioid crisis, so it's obviously in everybody's minds on the streets. We see it. There's obviously a mental health crisis out there. I don't think anybody can deny that. But the amount of overdoses that correctional officers are dealing with currently is unbelievable. We had an overdose this week, on the weekend. But those staff, I mean, they're face-to-face, they're doing CPR, they're basically found somebody dead and brought them back to life. In some cases, we don't. I would say 95% of the time we do get to them and give them Narcan before they pass away. But, I mean, that experience, that kind of trauma all the time, it's going to have an effect on people. Yes. I don't know if it's more and more of the inmates having mental health issues or if it's just the fact that it's diagnosed or it's recognized now where, I mean, I would say the majority of people that we deal with aren't quite right. So now that we're more aware, we get more of a diagnosis. But yeah, it's definitely huge. As far as training, it's pretty basic. There is, in the last few years, there's been they call it mindfulness-based resiliency training for all staff, which is basically just how to deal with stress, how to deal with, like, on a personal level. We as managers get training on how to deal with employees with mental illness. A lot around accommodation, a lot around recognizing how to identify somebody that's struggling and pointing them to the resources. In the last couple of years, we've moved we used to have CISM, which was Critical Incident Stress Management, which was a program where they contacted people and ran them through scenarios and did debriefs and all that kind of thing, to a peer support program. So now we have, it's a volunteer position, but really good uptake where if there's a situation like a suicide attempt, a serious assault on staff, then they have these peer supporters that will actually contact the employee off duty, check in on them, see how they're doing, move forward. So it's certainly not a perfect system. I think we could probably still do more, but definitely there's a commitment from the ministry to try and address some of the mental health in the workplace. I would say most of our people come from a loss prevention. There's corrections program specific, law and security, all kind of that stream from college is probably where the bulk of our applicants come from. But we do get people have university education that wanted to change or something different. And we also get a lot of people that have experience that have worked in the private sector that are looking for something different or their next career or whatever. So I don't know that you can specifically say that this is the best avenue to go forward. But I would say the bulk of our people come from a corrections or a police-based program. I'm not sure who is. Yeah, there's a corrections course that's for Sanford and Peterborough. We actually take students from there, and they do student placements as part of their college program. So we do connect with them for that purpose, and I think there's Durham College as well. No, it hasn't changed. So it's open to the sky, so you can get rained on or get sunshine on you. But there's a gauge between you and the sky and concrete walls around you. So no, it's as far as getting out and touching grass. There's a couple of areas we do have that are within the institution where there's a native garden and yard, and then we are actually working on another section where it'll be grassed and be a true outdoor area, but it'll be more focused on our inmates with mental health rather than the general population. Thank you. I wouldn't say that that's something that's grown a lot over the years. I think it's something that happens. You know, I mean, we do roughly have probably 400-ish use of force incidents. So, I mean, when you're using force on people, it's going to happen. Somebody's going to fall down, hit a knee, twist an ankle. I mean, we do have staff that get assaulted. It's a reality of the job. Obviously, we try and take steps to prevent that, but it's a reality. So I would say that the mental health side of it is probably more of an issue for us from a staffing perspective than the physical injury side of it is. I don't know if I can answer the first question. I would surmise that it's probably a cost of building versus maximizing space, and probably staff injury on the stairs is probably the last thing in their mind when they're designing the building, if I had to guess. As far as control of the stairs, I would say that's not a common thing for us to have issues on the stairs. So the inmates aren't supposed to be up on the top tier during day room, which is part of it. Secondly, we're always trained to say, okay, get off the stairs before I come up. Like, you don't cross paths with people on the stairs if you can avoid it. Obviously there's going to be times where people aren't doing what they're told and you've got to go down the stairs, but generally staff have control of the inmate by the time they're going to the stairs, so I wouldn't say that that's a common injury for somebody falling down the stairs, but I don't know why they would design a building with stairs. I would imagine it, especially in the bigger centers, I would imagine it has more to do with footprint and cost of construction than the actual safety. And yeah, no, I don't know what to say other than I agree with you, but I do know that the buildings that they've constructed recently are all multiple floors, so whether there's an opportunity to take somebody in an elevator when you're having an issue with them, I know our building, the only area where we house inmates that we go up and down floors that where there's an elevator is Unit 8, which used to be our segregation area, now it's a mental health unit, for lack of a better term, but... internally is the simple answer. So we do have body scanners now. They were really effective when they first came out because, say, before body scanners, generally how inmates packed their packages was, I don't know if you guys are familiar with Kinder Eggs and the little round cylinder that comes inside. They would pack that full of drugs, tape it up really good, and insert it into their body cavities to bring it in. So obviously we're not going to pick that up in a strip search. When we first got the body scanner, we were able to pick those up because they were hard, dense packages that were easily to see on a scan. So now what we're seeing is inmates will actually package them in ways that they look like organic or fecal matter on a scanner. So what they'll do is they'll package them up into little pellets and connect them and swallow them. So there'll be somewhere throughout their intestinal tract, and then eventually they'll pass. But as every time we get a new tool, they find a new way to get around it. It's big business. It's huge money. I should have brought some statistics, but I know it's hundreds of thousands of dollars in drug movement that goes through that jail. Yes. So one of the latest kind of ways that they introduced that is through the bail program. So I've got money as a result of my organized crime business. So I pay my low-level street user and say, I'll give you some money. I'm going to post your bail on your low-level charges, and then I'm going to withdraw your bail. But before I withdraw your bail, you're going to take all these packages, fill your stuff up, and then when you come back into custody, you're going to distribute where it's supposed to go. No problem. Yes. There's physical requirements to come into the jail, but they don't have to maintain them. The only exception to that would be our crisis intervention team. They do like an annual research, physical research, but for a general correctional officer, they have to meet a very, it's not a real high benchmark for physical fitness, but they do have to meet a benchmark for physical fitness to get hired, but once you're hired, there's no requirement beyond that. So superintendent, is the top, and then we have a deputy superintendent of administration, and then there's six deputy superintendents, three of operations, one of programs, one of finance. Organizational structure, yeah. No, so outside, I report to an Eastern Regional Director. She's based in Kingston, and then there's a Deputy Regional Director who's actually local, started at Central East Correctional Center. Policies made corporately through, flows down from our ADM, our Associate Deputy Minister, through the Deputy Minister, and of course, our Minister, I believe, is Michael Kirzner currently. So that's really how the governance flows as far as policy and procedures go. Not at our site. I think right now, probably the only expansion that's going to affect us will be the new institution in Kempville. And then they're expanding St. Lawrence Valley Treatment Center to and Brockville Jail. Brockville Jail is actually, I think, the oldest operating facility in Canada, so it's going to close at some point. So they're going to build a new facility there, as well as St. Lawrence Valley is a joint venture with Royal Ottawa Hospital, so they're going to make some beds there for females that require mental health treatment. No, but we still do that. Like we still, I guess, abide by that agreement. So when an inmate's released, we have institutional drivers or we use correctional staff to drive them back to wherever they were released from. It used to be easier for us to release in the community just because we had the Greyhound bus and we could drop them off the Greyhound bus with a ticket. Now we don't have that, so we have vans on the road every night going to wherever, or we'll send them in a taxi and at our expense to take them back to their community. That has changed. So we do not have funded officers from Cortha Lakes Police Service. I worked with the chief to amend some of our policies to kind of limit that strain on their police force. Interestingly enough, it became policy in the province after we made our agreement, but we do work closely with Kawartha Lakes Police, but that funding, we were funded for 3 officers at one time when it first opened, and there is no longer any funding from the province. I believe they're having the same issue in Penetang with policing costs. I only know that just from reading in the newspaper, but... No. I can definitely see where this community would be in arms over that loss of funding, because it's a huge impact to lose the funding for 3 officers in your community, especially when you have an institution that is creating the amount of workload that I'm sure we create for Kawartha Lakes Police. I know they're in there fairly frequently. Yeah, oh, I can imagine. I know that I was involved in some of that, not that I had any influence on the conversation, but I was aware of the conversations that were going on between the minister and Chief Mitchell. It's always our procedure to negotiate first, so... we do have a crisis negotiator team, so they're dispatched in a team of 4, so they have a primary, a secondary, a scribe, and an alternate. So the crisis manager is the senior manager on staff, so they'll decide whether to activate that team, an institutional crisis intervention team. I would say 99 out of 100 times we're going to activate those teams because it's better to have them on their way to the jail than to say, maybe we don't need them and then actually need them and cause that delay. So, but in the meantime, staff are observing. They're trying to negotiate with the inmates to get them to go back in their cell. If the negotiations fail, which I would say is probably... maybe 20% of the time in that situation where we have an activation of both teams and we actually have to use force, it's pretty rare. But our crisis intervention teams, although we don't have firearms, they do have chemical munitions, so they have a variety of different methods to deploy pepper spray into the units. We have ones that are it's a Mark 46, which looks like a fire extinguisher. It'll reach like 30 feet out with your pepper spray, right down to like a Mark 4 that will only go about 6 to 8 feet in front of you. We also have pepper ball launchers, which are classed as an impact weapon, so they're like a paintball gun on steroids with an actual hard ball instead of a soft one. And when it hits something hard, it breaks apart and a pepper dust goes out. So you have those, as well as your handheld stuff with shields and ass batons and 36-inch batons. So those teams are deployed. It's always a 5-person team, but if it was a whole unit, you'd probably be looking at probably 3 to 4 teams deployed in that situation to ensure that they go back to their cells. We have had 2 drone drops. Fortunately, because of the way our yards were constructed, although they're not as nice to the sun, it made it easier for us. We put a tighter mesh screen on, and we haven't really had an issue with drone drops since. I know it's a huge issue in some of the federal penitentiaries, but it hasn't been a big issue for us. Actually, our first drone drop, going back to Kawartha Lakes Police, did a great job, and we actually caught the first people doing the drone drop red-handed with the drone. So I don't know if that helped discourage it, but we've been fortunate here where I think proxemics too to roads probably helps us out too, because it's a pretty big distance to get from anywhere to the cells. So yes.
Yeah,
I'm sure it has happened. I'm trying to think of a... I wish I had a penny for every time I've been threatened, but... for them to actually follow through, I don't know that there's... that I can think of a case where that's actually happened. Generally, my experience has been when I run into somebody that's been in our custody, that they're pretty... It's like a, hey boss, how are you, kind of thing. I'm out, I'm doing good. I get that more than I get any sort of animosity on the street. But in the case of a legitimate threat, we do have... the OPP runs a program called JOPIS. I wish I knew what it stood for, but that's exactly what it's there for. So they'll come up with like a safety plan. They can suppress license plate numbers so that people can't look them up. They can suppress your address on your license if there's actually like a legitimate threat where they feel like somebody's at risk. We have employed that from our institution. Even recently, correctional officers found some pretty good evidence in a murder trial. So. We consulted with that group in that case. So, it does happen, but I can't think of an actual scenario where there's been a really bad outcome in the community. Yes, unfortunately. I hate to highlight it because I think it's assuming every correctional officer, except for the one that's doing it, would denounce that kind of behavior. It's kind of like the most despicable thing you can do as a correctional officer is to start bringing drugs in or weapons in. But it has happened, I think, 3 times that I can think of off the top of my head. So it's not that it doesn't happen, but it's not a common occurrence either. Yes. Nope. Thanks for asking, though. I think of course it's caused concerns, but I think as it becomes more and more prevalent, I don't think dealing with transgenders is a new thing for corrections. Like we had transgender individuals when I started, it wasn't as uncommon, but how we deal with them is definitely different. So they do get to choose where they go, but that's not as free as it sounds. There's a lot of consultation that's done with. We actually have like a human rights group that deals strictly with transgenders, and they look into where they are in the process and what their previous charges are, so that we place them appropriately. Because obviously, we have to consider the other people that where they're being placed and their rights as well. So it is quite a process, but I wouldn't say it becomes a problem. We get better and better at it every time we do it, but it's definitely it's a time sucker, we'll call it that. Well, I wouldn't say I wouldn't have them, then I wouldn't have a job. God, that's a loaded question. There's so many sides to that. Like, I know there's the big movement about decriminalizing things and not putting people in jail for small crimes or whatever, but that doesn't help the victim of that small crime. Like, you're still out whatever they stole out of your backyard, or you're still out, you still have to deal with the assault of you that occurred on you. You have to deal with all those things as a community member, so I don't really support that either. To me, I think it's bigger that they need to do a better job of getting the people at the top of the criminal chain versus the guy at the bottom. I don't know how they fix that. I think it's a bigger item. I know that bail reform is a huge thing right now with the catch and release criminals. I read about that in the news. But I see that we just don't have the infrastructure to support that, in my opinion. Since that's become a big news item, I think our count's gone up provincially 1,000 inmates since January. which is around when that bail reform talk started to happen. So it's kind of a double-edged sword where, I'm a pretty tough-on-crime kind of guy, but you have to have the infrastructure to support that. And the bigger answer around the mental health and how you... I think they need to bring back secure mental institutions where they have some intervention medically, because a lot of that stuff gets dumped on us as corrections, where we don't have the ability to treat them. So a Schedule One hospital, you can send somebody there. They have the ability to force medication. We can't force medication. So all we do is deal with the behavior, till the person either settles down or gets out. Obviously they have benefit of a nurse coming by their cell 3 times a day to encourage them to take their meds. So generally, somebody gets used to the program and settles down after time. But that's really the tool that we have. We have doctors on site, so they'll put somebody on a Form 1. We'll take them over to the hospital. Sometimes they'll be able to accept them and treat them, but most times they don't fall under that Form 1 criteria because they have us to take care of them while they're incarcerated. So they're not a threat to themselves or anybody else because we take that threat away, where in the community they may keep them on a Form 1. That's another loaded question. We've actually lost a lot of the teeth to our misconduct process. Because we're so overcrowded, it's hard to move somebody. The highlight on segregation, we try not to house people in segregation. So really what we've moved to locally and provincially, there's a SAFER program. It hasn't come to our site yet, but SAFER basically looks at their institutional record, their charges, everything else like that, and determines where they should be placed, whether it's a minimum, medium, maximum, like an internal classification system. So that's going on provincially. It hasn't come to us. We've kind of tried to get ahead of that. So we're actually doing our own version of it in-house. So we've kind of flipped. I kind of stole your question and went backwards, but we've kind of flipped from trying to hold people accountable for their actions to incentivizing them not getting in trouble, not breaking the rules, and giving them a little bit more freedom if they're going to behave and go that way. The reason for that goes back to the sentenced and not sentenced. So in 2002, when that building was built, it was about 70% sentenced offenders in provincial custody and 30% remanded. Now it's about 80% remanded and 20% sentenced. Comes into this conversation is when you're sentenced, you can take good time. So I can keep you in jail longer if you don't follow the rules. If you're remanded, I don't have that ability. Both the worst thing that I can do is, I can put you in segregation, but that's a lot of work for us, and it's not something that we can support. Or I can take your canteen and you can have somebody else buy it for you, which is the reality. So good and bad, but that's kind of how we're trying to get around it, is incentivizing good behavior.
Just for the purposes of the audience, the gentleman that's our presenter today has to leave by 11:30, and it's now 11:25.
Oh. Okay. Time flies. You might have to have me back for that part, I think.
All right. Time for one more.
Yes. Well, that's kind of like our internal classification, but that's kind of how we handle it. That is the reality. Like, we get everybody in that catchment area as soon as you're charged, you're coming to us. So whether you're charged with murder, drunk driving, domestic assault, everybody is coming to us until they're sentenced. So really the only way that we can deal with that is to just try and treat people the same regardless of what your charges are. We actually kind of encourage people not to focus on what people are charged with and just treat them as individuals, because your worst of your worst on the street may not be the worst of the worst for us. There's people that are career criminals that have been in and out of jail for as long as I've been working there, and they know the drill. They're more upset at the police that are taking away their freedom than us because they know that that's our role. You're going to come in, we're going to search you, you're going to go to your cell, we're going to feed you 3 meals a day, and eventually you're going to get out. So, I mean, we get, it's a different relationship, I think, than it is with the police on the street. So, in a lot of cases, that's how we deal with it, is just treating people on how they treat us or how they present at that time.
Thank you. Dave Robertson is going to thank our speaker.